Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Rise and Decline of the Redneck Riviera, an Insider's History of the Florida-Alabama Coast, by Harvey H. Jackson III, narrated by Perry Daniels. Introduction. Alabama Dreaming. In September 1944, on the island of Oahu, half a world away from his South Alabama home, a lonely corporal, Jule Rivers, Jack to his friends, rode his wife and infant son of the wonders he had seen. The coast, an active volcano, and Honolulu, which he described as quite a town. His journey had been a long one. It would be longer still. "This is only a stepping stone to where I am going," he told them. The war with Japan had brought him this far, and it would take him the rest of the way. While his mind was on what came next, it was also on what would be waiting in the States when the fighting was over. He had seen Waikiki Beach, with its curving stretch of sand dominated by the famous Royal Hawaiian Hotel and Diamond Head. Waikiki was very pretty, but there was somewhere else he would rather be. "I'll take the good old Gulf Shores any old day," he wrote. "Give me ALA in the USA, and I'll be satisfied." Not long after he mailed that letter, Corporal Rivers shipped out to New Guinea. Promoted to sergeant, he served as the waist gunner on a B-24 Liberator, flying with the 19th Bomber Group. On November 19th, his plane took off to attack a Japanese base on Mindanao Island in the Philippines. It did not return. Jack Rivers never saw Gulf Shores again. But many who served in that war did come back. And in the years that followed, veterans from the front lines and of the home front sought out sand and surf to relax and recover. Along the Alabama and Florida Gulf Coast, from the mouth of Mobile Bay east to St. Andrews Bay at Panama City, residents of the Lower South made the beach their own. Children of the Depression and of conflict, more hopeful, indeed optimistic, than they had been in a decade, they drove down on New Deal-paved military-improved roads in automobiles they bought on easy credit or with cashed-in war bonds. They came on vacation from jobs that they were trained and educated for under the GI Bill. They left behind homes financed through that same program. Few, if any, cared that their ticket to the middle class had been punched by the federal government. Along this coast, folks from the Lower South found a way of life, a culture and context, much like the one they left back home, segregated, where blacks existed at all, small town, provincial, self-centered and unassuming. Only the landscape was different. Few of the post-war visitors, even the ones who had served in the Mediterranean, would likely have made the connection that was made by a pre-war WPA writer who saw in Gulf Shores and Orange Beach reflections of little fishing villages that reminded the visitor of the southern coast of France. Nor is it likely that they would have made the alliterative association that years later Howell Raines, writing for the New York Times, made when he referred to this stretch of the Alabama shoreline as the Redneck Riviera. From there east to Panama City Beach was, as historian Patrick Moore of the University of West Florida described it, a provincial environment committed to tradition, conservative values, and a close tie to regional identity. Or that is what it has been for as long as I have known it, which is pretty much the length of time covered in this book. Let me explain. I grew up in South Alabama, in a little town about a 3-hour drive from Gulf Shores. That beach became our beach, our Disney World, a friend from childhood called it. Though I was just a tot, I still recall going down with the family in those years after my father returned from defeating Hitler. Later, I went back again and again, to deep-sea fish from Orange Beach, to dance at the hangout, and to sleep in my car or on the sand. Meanwhile, even as all this was occurring, my attention was being drawn east, over to a spot in Florida between Destin and Panama City Beach, where ancient dunes had formed a high bluff, and where a developer was selling lots. In 1954, my grandmother bought one. In 1956, she built a cottage there. And from then until now, Seagrove Beach, where nature did its best, has been my other home. It was there that I decided to write this book. So here it is. My account of how people from the Lower South created a coastal playground, a place where they and their families could get away from constraints and restraints of home and job and school and responsibility, but without going too far, physically or culturally, from where they were. It is the story of how those who were already there, and those who came later, turned fishing villages and bathing beaches into tourist destinations for millions, places where parties were pitched, dreams were dreamed, and fortunes were made and lost. And it is the story of how people keep coming, searching for something new, something old, something upscale, and something sleazy. What follows is how the Redneck Riviera began, what it became, and what is happening to it now. In the narrative are a number of themes that also deserve exploration and analysis on their own, and hopefully, what I have written will inspire others to have at it. In the evolution of the region, one can see how efforts to build a tourist economy led to new and innovative ways to promote the Gulf Coast. However, the new and innovative ultimately altered, threatened, and even destroyed the simple, laid-back, guilt-free enjoyment of tropical indolence that attracted Lower South Southerners at the start. Toward the end of the story, the region is increasingly dominated not by those who want to get away, but by those who want to create a coast with all the amenities and attitudes they left back home, only with sand and surf instead of suburbs and cul-de-sacs. This is also the story of how a desire to make money off tourists forced Gulf Coast folks to reconsider their attitude toward local government and the authority, bureaucracy, and taxes that came with it. Ultimately, they would give up their freedom from civic oversight in exchange for better roads, better-tasting water, a dependable sewage system, fire protection, and law enforcement. Many would not like what they got in return, but the deal was made nonetheless. Woven into this are accounts of the pioneers, who found ways to cater to the desires and urges of visitors and investors, and in the process, reshape the land and the landscape. They turned tourist courts into condominiums and bulldozed palmetto and scrub to make way for houses and communities that some would herald as the future of urban design and others would criticize for their clawing conformity. Then there are those who have been left behind, descendants of the first arrivals who came to the coast for their simplicity, watched as it changed and didn't like the result. The no-growth attitudes of residents who have theirs and don't want to share it would run headlong into the policies of those who consider the coast a commodity to package for consumers, developers who want to tame it, homogenize it, and make it palatable to people who are not rednecks, or at least do not consider themselves so. All of this has been played out in rituals that, like the coast, have become increasingly commercialized. Spring break, 4th of July parades, and a host of festivals that celebrate everything from the bounty of the Gulf to Beaujolais. At times along the way, this rush to capitalize on the opportunities the beach offers has been influenced, redirected, and sometimes stopped dead in its tracks by economic factors taking shape far from the coast. Burps and bubbles in national and international finance have been felt along the Riviera as developers and speculators have gotten rich and gone broke as a result of policies crafted in Washington and on Wall Street. And as if it were not enough that the fate of the coastal economy rests on decisions made by financiers in suits instead of locals in shorts and T-shirts, increasing concern for the fate of coastal creatures and their habitats has come in conflict with the belief, deeply held by many at the beach, that the coast is there for humans to exploit and enjoy, and that what happens to a mouse or a turtle is small stuff in the bigger scheme of things. But at the end of this story, mice and men, turtles and tourists, rednecks and real estate tycoons, have found themselves facing the same situation. when the BP Deepwater Horizon well blew and oil spewed into the Gulf, everything that walked, crawled, swam, or soared became threatened. Optimism, already dampened by recession, disappeared. As the extent of the disaster became known, a few people along the Redneck Riviera began to wonder if the compromises made to find the petroleum that fueled the cars and planes that brought people to the motels and condos were worth the danger offshore drilling posed to their way of life. However, most, in true coastal fashion, avoided alternatives that might involve sacrifice and restraint. Instead, they began to press the governments they so often held in contempt, local, state, and federal, to make a company once praised as a fine example of free market capitalism, clean up the mess, and reimburse coastal interests for what they lost. Though it was a time for serious soul-searching, the fact that so little of that was done may be one of the clearest indications of how attitudes that shaped the coast at the beginning of this story shape it still. Powton House South, Seagrove Beach, Florida, summer 2011. 1. The Coast Jack Rivers Knew. The beach that Jack Rivers wanted to see again was not much by Waikiki standards. The same could be said for most of what would become the Redneck Riviera. Down on the Alabama coast, there was no Royal Hawaiian, but there was the Orange Beach Hotel, which opened in 1923 and offered guests comfortable rooms with Delco system electrical lights and running water, but no indoor toilets. The building took a beating in 1926, when the unnamed hurricane that did so much damage in the Miami area entered the Gulf, turned north, and made landfall again near the mouth of Mobile Bay. But the Orange Beach Hotel survived and was modernized, plumbing and all, in the 1930s, with cottages added to accommodate the growing number of families coming down. The year after the hurricane, the Gulf Shores Hotel opened. Built from lumber salvaged from a storm-damaged Mobile Bay hostelry, it was a two-story structure with a bathhouse on the lower level and private cottages, one owned by Mrs. Dixie Bibb Graves, wife of Alabama Governor Bibb Graves. Vacation homes were also springing up, the first built in the 1920s by a couple of Mobile businessmen. Laid out on the Milltown shotgun house plan with screened sitting and sleeping porches all around, they were harbingers of things to come. By the 1930s, these retreats were joined by other cottages of similar design, a green box roofed by a green pyramid and propped on creosote poles, recalled a member of the family that built theirs from cheap pine mill ends and cheaper Depression labor, and named it Sandcastle. Getting to the coast was no easy matter. Travel was routine as far as Foley, some 15 miles inland, but from there the trip continued on a teeth-rattling wooden corduroy road and over a one-lane pontoon swing bridge that could be opened to let boats pass up into freshwater creeks to ride out storms or clean sea worms off their hulls. Anchored and docked in the coves and bayous behind the beach, these boats were among the many reasons visitors came down. As early as 1913, and maybe earlier, there were locals who would take tourists out through the pass to fish deep water for 75 cents a day. Once beyond the breakers, it was only a brief run to the 100-fathom curve, a dramatic 600-foot drop in the floor of the Gulf where red snapper, grouper, and other popular fish clustered to feed. There, upcountry folks, who had only fished for catfish and crappie, could catch the big ones, and as word of this bounty spread, fishing for hire became the Orange Beach industry. By 1938, a booklet titled Tour Guide to South Baldwin County told of fishing camps opposite the Gulf of Mexico inlet that led to Perdido Bay, and of a fleet of charter boats available at most reasonable rates with experienced fishing guides and navigators in charge. That same year, captains and crew organized as the Orange Beach Fishing Association, and off into the promotional future they sailed. About this same time, there began to appear among coastal folks an attitude that might have passed unnoticed had it not later become a defining characteristic of the people and the place. You could see it in Carl Taylor Zeke Martin, who, after the 1926 hurricane, homesteaded acres of beachfront that the government told him he could keep only if he tilled the soil. But the soil was sand, and raising crops was not what Zeke had in mind. So he planted fig trees, which he proudly pointed out to the homestead inspector as evidence of his intention to do what the government told him he must do. Only, of course, it wasn't. When the federal official left, Martin let the birds eat the figs, such as they were, and settled back to enjoy life on the beach. Charter boat captain Herman Calloway was cut from the same cloth. In the 1930s, the federal government levied a tax on charter boats and yachts. Calloway refused to pay it. Revenue agents arrived and Calloway ran them off. Then down from Mobile came the president of Waterman Steamship Corporation, who had heard of Calloway's defiance and wanted to tell him that his company was going to fight the tax as well. It did. It won, and the tax was repealed. Corporate giant and charter boat captain, united in a common wariness of what the federal government, or any government for that matter, might do that they didn't want done. However, during the same period, and not for the last time, that same federal government pumped money into the Alabama coast and made the region more than it might have been. In 1931, the U.S. Corps of Engineers began building the Alabama section of the Intracoastal Waterway, and when it was finished 2 years later, it had turned South Baldwin County into an island, Pleasure Island, Governor James E. Big Jim Folsom would later christen it. The construction brought jobs and people, improved the roads, and finally gave residents of Orange Beach and Gulf Shores a dependable bridge to what had become the mainland. A few years later, another government, Alabama's this time, struck a deal with a local landowner who gave and sold the state around 4,500 acres, including some prime beachfront, in return for helping develop roads in the villages. Then, with the heavy lifting done by federally paid Civilian Conservation Corps boys, the state cleared the scrub and palmetto and built Gulf State Park, complete with a casino for dancing and dining, a bathhouse, and cabins that families could rent for $10 a week. By the end of the decade, Gulf State was well on its way to being the most popular park in Alabama. If government was going to do anything, coastal citizens concluded, this was the sort of thing it should do. Slowly but surely, the region attracted more visitors, and as they came, local folks and outside investors scrambled to accommodate them. When two prospectors from Iowa appeared, looking for a hotel site, the Foley Outlooker reported that they were very profuse in praise for our bathing beach, and local landowners, eager to sell, began speculating which site the visitors would select. They didn't select any, but that disappointment hardly dampened the almost infectious optimism of coastal dwellers. With little or no state, county, or municipal authority down there to tell residents what they could or could not do, could or could not be, they could dream great dreams, unfettered by regulation or reality. So when the prospectors left, locals returned to their normal routine and waited for the next opportunity to arise. In Orange Beach, the normal routine was fishing. Camps, complete with lodge sleeping accommodations for anglers, were built along the bayous and coves. One even had a small Texaco gas station and store offering day snacks and ice. And most had skiffs for rent. Soon the newspaper in Foley was reporting month-long visits by families and friends from as near as Montgomery and as far away as Illinois, there to enjoy the good bathing and fishing. Bathing being what they called swimming until the 1940s, when bathing came to be associated with personal hygiene and swimming with recreation and physical fitness. To attract fishers and bathers, the Fishing Association began advertising what its members had to offer and encouraging those interested to telegraph Foley for reservations. From there, the messages would be hand-carried to captains in Orange Beach. Not the most efficient, and certainly not the swiftest way to secure accommodations and make arrangements, but it had to do until the 1950s, when telephone service finally arrived. Thus the seeds of a future were sown. Prosperity would come to the coast if locals could attract more visitors, with promises that they could leave their cares, and maybe their inhibitions, behind, while they fished, surf-bathed, and relaxed. It was paradise, Alabama-style, and in the late 1930s, as the Great Depression seemed to lose steam, and before war took so many away, it was what increasing numbers of Alabamians enjoyed, if they could afford it. Across the Florida line, things were a little different, but not much. The Florida Panhandle and Alabama were so closely connected, physically and culturally, that back in 1900, as the new century opened, the Young Men's Business League of Pensacola began lobbying for Alabama to annex Florida all the way to the Apalachicola River. Arguing not only the economic advantages of such a union, pro-annexation forces pointed out that there were more natives of Alabama in West Florida than of any other state, not counting native Floridians, who are in many cases children of natives of Alabama. Obviously, the effort failed, but the connection on which it was predicated continued to influence the growth of West Florida, whose beaches many Alabamians found easier and often more fun to visit than their own. Despite the sentiments of its Young Men's Business League, by the end of the First World War, Pensacola had settled comfortably into being Florida. With tourism, timber, and the military, the city had the largest and most diverse economy on the panhandle. The beach, however, was not the city's main attraction. Although in years past there had been talk of how Pensacola's part of Santa Rosa Island would become the Coney Island of the South, it did not happen. The beach, across the bay and on the other side of the island, was difficult to reach. In 1924, after reading about the wonders of Pensacola and the Gulf, a couple of Alabama boys rode their bikes all the way down to the coast. Pensacola was pretty much as advertised, but across the bay, on the island, biking was difficult. The closer they got to the water, the deeper the ruts in the sandy road became. "So deep we had to push on level ground," one of them wrote later. That part of Florida, the young adventurer recalled, was nothing like the stuff I had been reading about. But interest in the island was growing. A few years later, the Pensacola Bridge Corporation was formed. It leased a couple of miles of island and shoreline and began constructing a bridge from the mainland that would draw people to the resort the company planned to build. In 1931, the bridge opened, just in time for the onset of the Great Depression. Despite the odds against it, the Pensacola Beach Resort was built, a little smaller than initially planned, and it survived, though barely. It would be the core of what would later be known simply as Pensacola Beach. Pensacola residents were quick to take advantage of the new span. Those who could afford it built cottages on the island, which was close enough to allow them to leave town after work on Friday and be sitting and sipping on their porch at sunset. Soon, a weekend migration to the beach became part of affluent Pensacolians' summer routine. Local entrepreneurs came as well and built motels, though they weren't called that yet. By the end of the decade, the beach was illuminated for night bathing. A casino for dining and dancing had opened, and a fishing pier had been built out into the Gulf. It was a start, albeit a slow one. Though city fathers touted the sand and surf, there was more to do in Pensacola than visit what was still a largely undeveloped island. So most of the Depression-era tourists who visited the town, what few there were, spent most of their time on the mainland and took day trips over to the coast. In 1937, not long after U.S. 98 was completed to connect Pensacola to the rest of the panhandle, the Florida State Road Department put out a tourist booklet, Highways of Florida. There was no mention of Pensacola Beach. To the east of Pensacola were little communities like Navarre, best known in the 1930s for the story of how its founder, a Colonel Guy Wayman, chased off his ex-wife, who was also his adopted daughter, things can get a little strange down there, and warned her that if she ever came back, he would shoot her. She came back. He shot her. But having warned her, local law enforcement figured she should have known better, so Wayman went free. A little further east was the town of Mary Esther, which had been settled before the Civil War and named, locals think, for a member or members of the founder's family. Along the coast, precision is often optional. Neither Navarre nor Mary Esther was on the beach. They were on the north side of Santa Rosa Sound, the narrow body of water that separated tree-crowned Santa Rosa Island from the mainland and protected settlements from storms. The 1939 WPA publication, Florida, A Guide to the Southernmost State, told how both communities attracted visitors and investors who built tourist and summer camps, beach cottages, and substantial houses that overlook the placid waters of the Sound. Those who wanted to enjoy the bathing and fishing could jump or drop a hook off their dock into the water, or row over to the island, walk across, and play in the surf. The eldest son of an Alabama family that lived on one of the lakes north of Montgomery told of how in the 1920s his family would go down for a week or so. Lake raised and experienced in water, he and his siblings refused the boats offered them and swam across to the island instead. Once there, they had the beach all to themselves. Then there was Fort Walton, also on the north side of the Sound, which also had no beach and no fort, for that matter. It had been Camp Walton once, but was renamed, and by the early 20th century there were a couple of small hotels for tourists and salesmen traveling through. Then in 1927, a local visionary, Thomas E. Brooks, leased land on Okaloosa Island, not a separate island really, but the east end of Santa Rosa, across the Sound from Fort Walton. There, Brooks set to building cottages for the visitors he knew would come. Only they didn't. Okaloosa was isolated from the mainland, without much to do but play in the water and sit in the sun, and the first season he could not get anyone to stay overnight. That, however, would change. Across the pass that led from the Gulf to Choctahatchee Bay and separated Fort Walton from the eastern panhandle was Destin. Settled before the Civil War by a New England fisherman whose descendants still live there, the luckiest little fishing village in the world, as it came to be known, was lucky because it was as close to the 100-fathom curve as Orange Beach, if not closer. And as they did from Orange Beach, charter boats took out visitors from Destin to catch everything from mackerel to snapper to grouper to an occasional billfish. Destin was also lucky, it was told, because during Prohibition, boat captains were well positioned to sail out, connect with rum runners, and bring the liquor in to thirsty folks on shore. Orange Beach and other coastal communities had their share of that trade, and there would not be better bootlegging until the 1960s and 1970s, when marijuana became the contraband of choice. While Destin was blessed with a beautiful and easily accessible beach, fishing was what brought people there, and accommodations like those in Orange Beach were the rule. Though the opening of U.S. 98 in the mid-1930s made it easier for beach-loving tourists to get to Destin and the rest of the panhandle, at the end of that decade it was still being described as a fishing resort. With only 25 year-round residents in Destin, anyone visiting on the eve of World War II would have believed its future would forever be linked to its charter fleet and to the men who operated the boats. They would have been wrong. Between Destin and Panama City was some 60 miles of largely deserted coastline, distinguished by tall dunes and coastal dune lakes. In ancient times, much of this was an island, cut off from the rest of the coast and countryside by Destin Pass to the west, Phillips Inlet to the east, and Choctahatchee Bay to the north. Old folks still called it the island, though they had never known it when it was. With a few exceptions, the completion of U.S. 98 did little to immediately relieve the isolation of most of the people who lived there. The shrimpers and oystermen back on the bay, the few timber crews cutting what was left of the
Sample complete. Ready to continue?